The Cosmic Shed.
Hello, and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. And today's episode is all about October Sky. If you haven't heard our last episode, October Sky Part 1, then now is as good a time as any to download it and have a listen to that. In it, you'll find Ty and I chatting with the wonderful Homer Hickam, the man portrayed by Jake Gyllenhaal in October Sky. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Ty.
And...
Tushna.
And...
Achintia.
I'm exceedingly excited because that man that you just heard is Achintia Rao.
And I think of
him. And most people would be excited to meet him because he works at the CMS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. I'm excited to have him in the shed because he's the shed's first ever subscriber.
Subscriber number one in the shed today for the first time. Yes.
But not the first time on a Cosmic Shed episode, because Achintia was on our episode about Theory of Everything.
That's right. Yeah, I interviewed a theorist working at CERN at the time, Dr. Subodh Patil, who is a theorist who was working on relativity and so forth in his work. And yeah, I spoke to him about things like imaginary time and whatnot.
It was amazing. It was really amazing. Thank you so much for doing that. And thank you for joining us here in the shed today. We're going to talk to Achintia about CERN and October Sky and lots of other things as well, no doubt. And Tushna, who you just heard, is no stranger to the shed, having appeared on our Ghostbusters episode Actually in the Shed and two of our live episodes, the two Star Trek ones.
Yes, indeed.
Lovely to have you back. Always a pleasure. So, October Sky.
The film came out in 1998 and was directed by Joe Johnson, who had previously directed the likes of The Rocketeer, which is one of my favourite films, and he's also directed Jurassic Park 3, which is not one of my favourite films. And the first Captain America film, which is good fun. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal, post-City Slickers and pre-Donnie Darko. So he was 16, I think, Homer said, when we spoke to him.
Yeah.
And it follows four boys living in Colwood in West Virginia, coal mining town, and essentially all men end up working in the mine because it's a company town. And that's just what you do. And Homer and his more mentally gifted friends decide that they don't want to spend their lives down mining coal. They want to do something more with their lives. And with Sputnik being launched and the dawn of the space race, they decide that they're going to build rockets and prove their scientific mettle to get out of the town and do something more with their lives.
I love it.
It's great. I love it.
Yeah, and Tushna, in addition to you watched it, was it for the first time last
week? It was indeed. Yeah.
So I had to do my best to sort of hide my emotions from Tushna. Just like, I will not cry. Yes, it was a good movie, I think. It was quite enjoyable. I loved it. I really loved it. And although from Homer's interview we know that the film was written in a very different way from the movie, some things were embellished for being better for Hollywood and for the big screen and so forth. So as he said, largely things that happened, but the bits in between were a bit embellished, and that's all right. You can take that with a grain of salt. I thought overall the movie was really enjoyable. Got me very emotional. In Homer's interview, he mentions the fact that they had this scene where he went down the mine, because he never actually skipped school to go work in the mine. But they had this really really beautiful scene, and he said they had the hole, so they needed to use it. So they shot him with going down the mine for the first time with his fellow workers, and he looks up and he sees. He sees Sputnik flying overhead, this little dot of light just traversing the sky with millions of other dots of light. And that was a very beautiful scene, just in terms of the way it was shot and the symbolism of Homer's light was switched off in some extent. And the light was above him, the light was in space kind of going across the sky. I really liked that. That scene was very beautiful. And we know that it didn't happen in reality, but it was a very powerful scene for me.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent too. Very, it had that wonderful sort of 80s, 90s Stand By Me kind of vibe, you know, the kids and the railway tracks and all of that. And I think I also really enjoyed the sort of family relationships in that, although I know that wasn't exactly accurate. Homer was saying that, you know, his mom was a lot more of a father figure and his dad. You know, I think what Homer said about his dad made more sense, considering who he was in the mine in reality. And but still, that character, you know, their relationship was really, really interesting. That sort of classic great American dream and how far you can push it. Yeah, it was a very good film and fairly heart-wrenching in bits.
yeah. Completely. I mean, as an amateur astronomer myself, and I think a few of us in the shed here look to the sky quite a lot, that the sheer darkness and claustrophobia of the coal mine in contrast to the big sky filled with stars, it's just brilliant, isn't it? As you know, as you were saying, Chintu, with the when it actually is slap bang in your face. And Homer said that he didn't think when he saw that scene that anyone was going to buy it.
Yeah,
but you just do, don't you? You swept along with it, and it's brilliant.
It's incredible. I think while we were watching the movie as well, my phone beeped at some point to say that the ISS is going to be flying over our head in 5 minutes. Because I have it set up to tell me when the ISS is going to be above our heads. And Tushan's like, do you want to step out and watch it?
And that definitely was true, is that, you know, I was very, very, very young when my dad sort of pointed out the stars and pointed out that you could see satellites. And it's something that I've just always grown up with. You know, I've grown up with having human things in the sky that you could always see. And it was amazing to think that, you know, when they saw Sputnik, that was the first thing. I mean, especially in light of recent other films like Hidden Figures and that again, that feeling of doing that for the first time. I can't imagine what that must have been like, you know, just like the moon landings. It's just something that we just are like, yeah, I've been to the moon. Maybe we'll feel that way when we go to Mars.
When's that happening?
Oh, God, I think I'm quite the pessimist. If you ask Elon Musk, it's happening next year,
Did you say? Yeah, I think
so. Next year, 2020, something like that. I'd be quite pleased if it happened in my lifetime.
Yeah. I'll tell you what is happening next year, and that is part-time scientists, PT scientists, are taking two rovers to the moon. It's something that really chimed with me in terms of October Sky. Obviously, October Sky is a film about a group of boys chasing a dream to the stars. And I think you'll hear there are quite a few similarities between Homer Hickam's Rocket Boys and these guys. I managed to catch up with Carsten Becker, who is the electronics expert at PT Scientist, shortly after their announcement that they booked a space on one of Elon Musk's rockets.
So our goal is to land a rover on the moon by mid next year. And we want to go to Apollo 17, and especially we want to go to the lunar rover vehicle that has been standing on the moon for more than 45 years, and we want to see what happened with it.
The thing is, right, I want to do that, but I can't. So how can you do that?
Well, you have to try really hard, then you have to convince yourself that this will eventually work, and after just a few years, you will start to realize that it might be possible. So... Well, it really just started by the end of 2008, which is not yesterday, as you may know. And, you know, we started without any knowledge about space. You know, we are not space scientists or any of the like. So we sat together and we were like, hey, you know, we should participate in this competition where you have to send a rover to the moon. And so we started thinking about it. And this is how we got started, and we've been working on it ever since.
Okay, but so what was it about Apollo 17 that made you want to go there?
Well, there are several reasons. One of them is that it's a nice place to land. There is many pictures of it available, so you know that there aren't any big boulders or rocks or whatnot. There's also quite a bit of geographical data available. But I think the most important part is that it's the last place where men set foot on another celestial body. And I think continuing the story from there is something that's pretty nice. It also was the only mission where they actually took a scientist with them. And so there has been some proper science being done. And we want to figure out if any of those... you know, could be improved upon.
Are they going to drive up to the moon buggy?
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be awesome. You kind of want to send people there to see if it still works.
Still works, yeah. Chokes a bit. It was solar powered.
Yeah.
It was.
I wonder if, you know, it's been impacted or anything like that. Don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. When the rover gets to the moon, it's going to... there's two rovers, is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
So there's two rovers. They go to the moon. They're going to trundle along very nicely
to the Apollo 17 landing site and disprove all the conspiracy theorists wrong again. And
but I think conspiracy theorists are really immune to any facts, so I'm not sure they are convinced. And in particular, our rover is participating, as you may have seen in the Alien Covenant movie. So, you know, we are making, we are helping the conspiracy series to form a new one, you know, that we are taking Ridley Scott to produce our moon show. developing the rover is the easy part, because it is something that you can test. You can take a rover, you can put it in a desert, you can drive around, you can see it works, it doesn't work. The space testing a spacecraft is something that's significantly more difficult, because the first test in the proper environment will be on in orbit. You know, it's very hard to do. You can't the thrusters we are buying, for example, will not work in air, and then you have the gravity problem, and you know, you can't test fire them easily, and so this is getting very complicated. And so what we did to develop electronics is essentially we developed hardware for the rover that we are going to reuse in the spacecraft as well, you know, because this allows us to test the hardware quite a lot, but make sure that it also works in the spacecraft. And then we just have to have the proper test procedures and software simulations, and everything will work as planned. I'm pretty sure about that.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. I have no doubt that it will.
You don't? Okay.
No.
At least one of us.
What? It's, hang on a second. You just said that your rover's going to be in the Alien Covenant movie.
Yeah. There has been a trailer where it has been seen for about 3 seconds. It will be a short appearance, but we can say that we have been on another planet before we have been to another celestial body.
Yeah, amazing.
So that's cool.
That's really cool. Excited about Alien Covenant?
I'm cautiously optimistic.
Why?
You
saw...
I saw Prometheus.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating failure. There were some aspects of it that I kind of liked. And then when the guy who has the map reading equipment gets lost and... The biologist sees a weird tube worm thing, takes off his gloves and starts prodding it in the face. It's like, I'm sorry, are you all idiots?
Have you not seen it?
Yeah.
Prometheus? No, yeah. But I kind of want to. I mean, I know it's a... So I have my ears in my... my fingers in my ears at the moment, because I don't want to get spoilers, even though
it's like, not... people are idiots in it, which annoyed me, because in these films, people should be... smart.
Right.
And I'm kind of cautiously optimistic about Alien Covenant, but I fear from the trailer that I've seen, they've shown at least 5 people I know who are going to die. But I think post-Prometheus, Ridley's got back on his game with The Martian.
Yeah, I know.
So,
absolutely.
You know...
Yeah,
we all make mistakes.
How do you feel about? Sorry to interrupt you, Andrew. Mm. How do you feel about them showing revealing too much in the trailers these days? It seems to be a trend to get people into some.
Yeah,
it's
showing
5 people dying, and if you looked at the trailer to Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, the one that they made into the movie,
Blade Runner.
Thank you. When they did the Blade Runner,
the new one.
Yeah, the trailer gave you nothing.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. It was it hit me emotionally without giving me anything of the story. I liked it. I really liked it. Yeah. And kind of, how do you feel about that? The fact that
I understand they need to get bums on seats, but really, for an alien film, all you've got to do is just show an alien and people running through corridors screaming. You don't need to show anyone dying or anything like that.
Yeah,
I think it's a bit of a trend though now, giving away too much in trailers. I think it's happening more and more, and everyone feels like they have to do it to keep up.
I think they have to get people in. It's like, you know, we've got to show them what they're missing out on if they don't go.
Like, don't go and watch this on Netflix, come to the cinema. But yeah, I mean, I if it's something I'm really looking forward to, and I do this even with things on, like, currently I've been acting crazy on Facebook trying to not see any spoilers for American Gods, because it's not out here yet. Sorry, completely random thing. But
it's going to be on Amazon Prime.
Amazon Prime in the next month. And, you know, I really don't want to see anything. Yeah, but, it's, you know, they do a million versions.
I've read the book. I can spoil it.
I read the book too, but I still don't want to see
it. Oh, come on. If you've read the book, you can't be spoiled.
I don't want to see an awesome scene and just see a clip from it, and then it's like, oh yeah, that would have been great, but I've seen it already. I want to be nicely surprised by it.
It's kind of with everything though, isn't it? Like if you watch a TV programme, it's a science documentary, and they say at the start, and they show you the best clips that's going to happen, and it's just like, why are you doing this? I've got 60 minutes attention span. That used to piss me off about
Battlestar Galactica at the end of the credits when they used to do that quick montage of scenes from the episode. Oh, don't do... What are you doing? We're about to watch the episode. Stop doing this.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, I liked what Battlestar Galactica did. Maybe it was because I was invested in it in a different way, you know?
Maybe.
The episodic nature of it meant that I was... And I binge-watched it. I didn't have to wait for the next episode to show up.
They do it in Thunderbirds. Uh-huh. In the old series of Thunderbirds, Thunderbirds are going, they'd show like a quick scenes of what's coming, and you'd be like, oh, this is going to be awesome, a tower falls down, or something's going to come out the pod, it's going to be great. But, you know, I was a kid, and it was just kind of like teeing me up for something awesome. Whereas with Battlestar Galactica, it's kind of, because it's, you know, an anthology, well, not an anthology, it's just an ongoing story arc, if you suddenly see Apollo screaming and his Viper blowing up. Like, oh my god, what's going on?
How did that happen? Why did that happen?
It's like, well, now I know he's going to blow up. Or is he?
Doctor Who's the worst, though. You know, it's like coming next week and then it gives you... It's like, no, I want... At the end of Doctor Who, I want the Doctor Who music to start so I can just... deal with what's happened, and then next week it'll be fine.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, now, listen, we're supposed to be here talking about October Sky.
Hey, let's have another detour and just say that Edward James Olmos is going to be in the new Predator film.
Yes.
That's great. Carry on. October Sky.
Okay. So, October Sky. Ty.
Yes.
You know and love this film already.
Yeah.
I know and love this film already. We've got a man who works at the Large Hadron Collider, and we've got somebody who works for Physics World, who have never seen the film before. Why is this film not embedded in the science culture? Why is it not part of everybody's psyche? The way that 2001 AD is, I know it's not that kind of level, but why is it not something that you were aware of? And
I'm just going to be very mean and say that we're a lot younger than you are.
I was going to say the same.
Oh, what?
I was going to say the same thing. 98. I knew it in the cinema by myself in 98.
To be fair, I didn't see it till 2003, and that was when Columbia exploded.
Yeah.
I did suddenly like a deep dive into astronaut stuff. I bought From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO miniseries, and then from that I bought the Wright stuff, and then I think I was just looking around for space films about real life NASA stuff, and I think October Sky just kind of came up.
When I looked into the background materials about the movie, I looked it up after we watched it, and it turns out that, well, October Sky is an anagram for the name of the book that Homer was writing at the time, which is Rocket Boys. And Hollywood wanted to, well, the producer wanted to change it to October Sky because they felt that Rocket Boys would exclude a large portion of society from wanting to watch the movie, because it might be, women over 30 might not really find that particularly appealing. That means Rocket Boys and October Sky. I would have picked Rocket Boys, right?
Yeah.
And that may be a thing. Maybe it breezed past me growing up. Or later on as well, not when it came out, but it just didn't register in my radar because the terms didn't particularly have.
Yeah. October Sky
does
sound
like a rom-com, rom-com title, bit, doesn't it?
When I found out that it was an anagram for the original title, that was like, okay, that's pretty cool. It happened in October. That's what Nick launched in 1957. I thought that was cool. I thought it was a really, really, really cool wordplay. But I'm guessing. If I'd come across it and it said Rocket Boys, and I would have either thought it was something about Elton John's childhood, or it would have been about space, and I might have gone and watched it. So I don't know. I don't know if that played a role or not.
I must admit, I'd never even heard of it. I had no idea what it was about. When you said it, I was like, Google. you know, there wasn't even a slight, like, oh, I've heard of it, might want to see it kind of thing. I wondered too. I'd not really heard of Homer. I hadn't really heard of this whole story. And I don't know. And there's a lot of films like that from that time that, you know, like you say, are very popular. Even things like, I don't know, Good Will Hunting or something like that.
That won loads of Oscars, yes, so it has certain,
yeah, so maybe it's that. But yeah, I think, but it was interesting because Homer said that, you know, the film was in cinema for like 2 weeks, but then lots of teachers picked it up. How did you guys come across it first? Because I don't even know if it was released in India. not sure.
I don't think it was really released here because it has no big names. Jake Gyllenhaal wasn't anyone of note. For Chris Cooper, this was pre-American Beauty. Laura Dern was in Jurassic Park, but she's not exactly a household
name. What about you,
Andrew?
I can't remember the first time I seen it. I know, I in my mind, in my memory, which we talked about on Inside Out, is not necessarily very reliable. I at the same time, I was in the Lake District here in England, staying in an amazingly dark sky area, and I looked up one night and saw two dots of light, two fairly bright, well, very bright dots of light going overhead, and I looked at the internet to see what it was, and it turns out it was the shuttle's last ever flight to the International Space Station.
Oh my God!
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Exactly.
When was this? When was the last?
Not very long ago. Five, six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's in my memory, at least. I kind of put that together with Homer looking up out of the coal mine and seeing. I was actually in a copper mine. I was staying at a copper mine and looking up at that. But that actually, in all seriousness, the impact that had on my life is dramatic. Nothing like Sputnik had on the psyche of Homer and his friends and everybody else. But is there anything else that you can think of that we've had in our lifetime? Obviously, Apollo was before all of us. Rosetta, possibly.
No, there was that time when a comet was going to hit Jupiter.
Yeah,
I remember staying up.
Yeah,
for Schumacher that.
Schumacher-Levy.
And Beagle 2.
No, it was later.
It was later. No,
Schumacher-Levy 9 was.
It was a little bit later.
It was in the books that I had when I was a child, so it was definitely.
I remember staying up, and there was like a late night thing, and then I hear the first photos, and it was like just screenshots of. Not much. Yeah, and I was kind of like, okay. Beagle 2, I remember the National Geographic pullouts on the whole build-up to that.
To be dreadfully honest, I don't think I had one of those on that level. For me, it was what science fiction drew me into science to start with. And then when I began looking about it, I was very young when I went and was taught about the moon landing and so forth. I learned the dates, it was written down everywhere. I had memorized the speeches that they'd given from bits that I'd found. And it was a bit historic. And I don't know, how are you, Tishna? Because we grew up not far from each other. And
yeah, I think.
I don't recall.
So I grew up in Bombay, which is a big city. It's really bright and you can barely ever see the stars. But actually, you can see a lot more stars in Bombay than you can see from London. I don't know why. Right outside my house, it's burnt so well into my memory that I just look for it everywhere. Orion. I could always see Orion. That was always Orion, you know.
Sure.
And I remember being really young and my dad taking me out to the park around the corner and showing me all the stars of Orion, pointing out the shape and telling me that if I ever got lost, Orion's belt pointed to the North Star so I could always orient myself. And that was it. That one time when my dad was just vaguely like, you know, I was in the park with him, 7:30 in the evening, must have been a summer evening because those were always clear actually. And I said, what's that? And, you know, he said, oh, yeah, that's Orion. Pointed out maybe one other constellation, because he really didn't know that many then, but he knew Orion too. And he was a good scout. They'd learned Orion's belt and pointing to the North Star. And there's no way you can see the North Star from Bombay and where India is, because it's really low on the equator. So you have to go somewhere really quite high up to be able to see it quite clearly. That was it. And the next day I was like, can I get a book about space, please?
I guess the question I've got in my head is, what is our Sputnik?
When Columbia blew up and Kalpana Chawla was on there, and she was the closest India had to someone who, you know, who we'd send into space kind of thing. So I remember before she went up there, there was a lot of news, and suddenly it was all, oh, fantastic, a woman and in space and brilliant. And so there was a lot of interest. And then I remember going to the planetarium after she died, and they had like a kind of little bit of a panel discussion, and her husband was there on the panel, and I remember just watching him cry, and he just I think it was too soon, it probably wasn't a good idea to roll him out for this international tour, he was still in bits. I remember sitting there and watching him kind of even though he was in bits and even though he was in tears, he was kind of saying, this is what she always wanted to do. She was made for this. And, you know, I don't think any of them would have decided not to do it they might have decided to do it differently, I'm sure. But, you know, that how important it was for the human race to be doing this. And I remember thinking, yeah, wow. Yeah. So that definitely, but quite a sad.
That's exactly what Frank Borman said when he was testifying about the Apollo 1 fire, wasn't it? And he actually read a letter or statement that Gus Grissom had said, or something like, if we die, you know, it's one step on the way to where we've got to go.
Yeah. Wasn't one of the cosmonauts actually Gagarin's friend, and they were both supposed to fly on. They were both training to fly on one of the missions later on, and they knew this was not going to work. It was a Soyuz. They knew it was not going to work because it had been a disaster from start to finish. They knew every engineering problem, and I think Gagarin was his backup.
It's embarrassing that I can't remember his name, but he chose to fly. He had the option of backing out, but he knew that his best friend Gagarin would then be on the flight that he knew was going to be disaster. And so there was disaster after disaster. The parachute didn't deploy. The backup parachute didn't deploy, and as he was crashing to the earth, I think the listening station in Australia picked him up, cursing in Russian, cursing the administration for having done this. Because he had to go up, he didn't have a choice.
And I'm always fascinated by that part of humans. I guess it's the psyche of endeavour. It is deeply heartbreaking, but it is also inspirational. One person who is also rather inspiring, following a dream quite literally to the moon, is of course Carsten Becker.
It's one thing saying I want to send stuff to the moon, it's another thing working out how to do it, but it's quite another thing getting a rocket and taking it to the moon with your rover on it. So how are you doing that?
Well, it's simple. You go to SpaceX.com and you say, I want to buy a rocket, and then you transfer some money and then off you go. Rockets are becoming more of a commodity that you can buy with just a bit of money. But the real technology challenge is getting to the surface of the moon. And this is where we started to develop our own landing hardware, or spacecraft, as you might call it. So it took us quite a few years to figure out how to do it properly, and this is mostly because we always had to change the rockets, because the rockets are a commodity, but you know, thinking about it, maybe that's not true at all, because we started developing for the Falcon 1E rocket from SpaceX, which you may know has never been commercially available, so we had to redesign our spacecraft, and then we decided to take the Dnepr, which is a Russian rocket. And then came the Crimea crisis, and so we had to choose another rocket again. And so this game went on for a few rockets. And so we eventually decided that the best way to design a spacecraft is to make one that can fit any rocket with any orbit, and so that we can adapt it easily to new requirements. And the result is it's a spacecraft that we call ALINA, which is the Autonomous Landing and Navigation Module. And yes, the letters are all in there somewhere. This is our spacecraft, and it can take 100 kilograms of payload to the moon. And one of the payload is two of our rovers that we designed together with Audi, which are called the Audi Luna Quattro.
Amazing.
Our mission works like this. So we bought a rocket, which will take our spacecraft to what's called a GTO, so a geostationary transfer orbit, which is around Earth still. And from that, we will take it with our own propulsion to the moon and circularize it, and then we land and disembark the two rovers and are pretty happy.
Okay, cool. That's so amazing. So when is this happening?
So the aim is to launch by about mid next year.
Yeah. I thought you'd bought time on the rocket, or you bought space on the rocket. So is it not a specific launch? You just said I'm doing it by this time, or how does that work?
Well, in general, as you may know, rocket launches are hard, and occasionally there are things that go wrong, and this can cause havoc to your schedule. So there is for example, the latest blow up from SpaceX has caused a delay of about 3 months. from the schedule. So, you know, those things are not, they are not fixed in stone, essentially, you know. Something always happens, and so, yeah, making a date is something that that is left to kind of like the last minute. But we need to provide an interval of about 14 days where the geostationary satellite and our mission can launch at the same time, so that you know, it can be shifted for within a 2-week span.
I mean, if you can just imagine for a moment how you feel on launch day when the stuff that you've been working on for all these years is sitting on one of those rockets that might blow up or might get to the moon.
Yeah, I guess I would be really hoping for the later one. It will probably be a train wreck of nerves, but it will be very exciting too.
So, Achintya, we've got you here. Tell us about CERN and the Higgs boson.
The Large Hadron Collider is often sold to people as the machine that would discover the Higgs boson, and that is true. But in many ways, it is nature has been hiding its guards very close, in the sense that we don't know what might be behind them. There are a lot of unanswered questions about the universe. We have a fairly decent idea of how things work, but we know that there are many gaps in our understanding, and we don't know what those gaps might be. So discovering the Higgs boson was just the first of our many steps in plugging those gaps and figuring out what is missing from our knowledge of the universe. And the really interesting way in which it is being described by some of my friends who are physicists themselves is that this is now a new tool in our toolkit. We can use the properties of this newly discovered particle to probe nature, to probe physics further and discover what's out there. So the LHC is going to operate for another about 20 years or so. And there's a lot of undiscovered territory out there for us to explore. It's kind of like you don't stop when you set off on a voyage. You don't stop at the first island you've discovered because there's an entire ocean out there with more to see. The theories tell us that certain particles should not have any mass. And if they don't have any mass, then they will not bind together. They will just be zipping along at the speed of light, and the universe would not exist in the way we observe it. So we know that they should have mass, but we don't know, well, we didn't know exactly why that might be. And there was a theory proposed to explain that. And if that theory was right, we needed to find a particle associated with this force that was being exerted. The really interesting thing as well is that, okay, we found one Higgs boson, or one type of Higgs boson, but if we find another, then there's potentially up to 5 of them out there. So,
like the Infinity Stones.
Yes, exactly like the Infinity Stones, actually. But the point, okay, so the good thing here, I'm glad you brought up the Infinity Stones, is that we know that there's 5 Infinity Stones, or do we? There may be more. There may be loads more Infinity Stones, or there might be none, or maybe there's just one.
An infinite amount.
Oh, that might be a bit boring. Oh, then it's just stones. Theory. So the standard model is pretty good, but then we've got there's all sorts of words for it, but there's new physics. And when they say new physics, is we're desperate to find things that are not in the standard model, because the standard model only goes so far. It's standard. And it doesn't explain everything. And we're desperate to find the bits that are not in the standard model. So beyond the standard model, or new physics. And that's, you know, you might hear words like supersymmetry, which is one possible theory, which is some of these supersymmetric particles is what the LHC has been looking out for, but unfortunately they haven't found any. So that might be the first one of the possible theories that we say, nope, sorry, it's not, doesn't quite work. Next, please. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the interesting part. And the LHC, it can go up to a certain energy. And actually, there's already very, very detailed plans for the next machine, because we already know that we're almost sure that we need to go to even higher energies. And
I was at the at CERN with this lovely man over here to show me around, you were having a conversation about the Large Hadron Collider being the accelerator for a much bigger particle accelerator.
Yeah, so what I find quite interesting is that if you look at CERN and the many accelerators that we have, there's actually an accelerator complex. You start off with smaller accelerators in size, and then you go to bigger ones. And the smaller ones can accelerate particles to a lower energy, and the bigger ones go to higher energies, and the subsequently bigger ones go to subsequently higher energies. And when you accelerate protons in the machine, you don't just put them straight into the LHC. You sort of shift gears like you would in a car. You start off in first gear, the smaller accelerator, then you put it into the next bigger accelerator, then to the subsequently bigger one, and so forth, before you finally put them into the LHC. And all those previous accelerators work as injectors, as we call them, for the next round. Okay, shifting gears. And indeed, there is a plan to build an accelerator that is going to be much larger than the LHC. So this is a 27-kilometer ring that we have right now. And the next one would be between 80 to 100 kilometers in circumference. And the LHC would then become an injector for that one.
Let me just say, though, that is one possible accelerator.
Right, yeah. This is the one at CERN, of course. We're not going to build...
There's ideas for straight ones, which is also
the International
exciting.
Linear Collider.
ILC Linear, one line, just one line. So it all depends. But there was a hope that we would find a few more interesting things at the LHC, which would then guide what's the best way to build the next one, rather than to... Because we don't have the theory. With CERN, with the LHC, they knew exactly, like, by the time the theory had come so far, that they knew the parameters. They knew what they had to build to get there. Yeah. And they were
to take a step back, we didn't really have much of a choice, because we just put the LHC into a tunnel that already existed with the previous accelerator. So we didn't have to really... But the really interesting thing about the one that they plan on building next is that it would not only circle one of the hills that we have in France, it would also happen to go underneath Lake Geneva.
Wow.
And it's a big civil engineering challenge as well, which I find particularly interesting.
Was particle physics, like, when did particle physics become part of your kind of love?
Oh, for a long time. From the time I was very young, I think astrophysics and particle physics were the two things that captivated me, and I think I'd known about CERN as a concept, if not intimately, well before the machine, well before the Large Hadron Collider was going to be switched on. I'd read about it in pop culture, and it had interested me for a long time.
Yeah.
And as someone who has grown up with a love for physics and fundamental research in general, to have this, to have myself at the window, just looking in from up close at the work that's going on, is really one of the great privileges that I have, because I'm embedded there in the place where the research is being done. And I might not be doing it, but I still have a sneak peek that no one else does. Mm. And that's pretty cool. That's really fascinating. And I get to take people around the detectors and show them, take them 100 meters underground and look at stuff. Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed for that. That was amazing. Mm-hmm. And so also, thank you, sorry to interrupt, but thank you very much indeed for my... I've actually got... What is this?
Right, so what you're holding in your hand right now is a black box that just so happens to be one of the tapes onto which data from the LHC are recorded. So at the LHC, when we generate several terabytes of data every year, every few years, we generate petabytes worth of data. And that needs to be stored somewhere. And we happen to store it.
The Cosmic Shed is a good place to store it.
No one comes here and we're perfectly safe.
I'm not sure it's safe from damp, though.
No, it's probably going to get ruined by next week. But... But so we write it literally onto magnetic tape rather than onto your hard disk drives and so forth, because the storage is both cheap and reliable. It's not particularly fast, because when you need to write out of this, you need to go and extract your tape cassette from some storage and then put it in, and then you need to read it sequentially. So, but it is cheap and it is reliable. And so this is what you're holding is what the data are recorded into. And this is from the year 2012, I believe, the year that the Higgs boson was discovered.
That is incredibly beautiful. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. There's about a terabyte of data on it. So you're holding one of the real tapes, and we're not using those anymore. So they've decided that we can sell them off. And in fact, this is going to good cause. The funds that they gather from selling these old used tapes with real LHC data on them, they go to the CERN and Society Foundation, which is helping to establish educational programs to bring kids to the lab and so forth. One of the things that I find personally a bit interesting is that from CMS we've been releasing a lot of open data, a lot of data that is used by the physicists themselves to make these discoveries. And this year we're going to release a whole load of data, several petabytes of data, so good luck analyzing that. good luck storing that, but we're going to be releasing... There's room in the shed. We just need a few more of those tapes, Andrew. stock them up. And the data that we're releasing this year is from 5 years ago, which was the year that the Higgs boson was discovered. So people around the world will have real LHC data associated with the discovery of the Higgs, and you, Andrew, could maybe rediscover the Higgs in that data. So, don't know. This is something that maybe the students will end up playing with in their schools, and that might become a way in for them.
Is the discovery of gravitational waves our Sputnik?
I'd like to think that gravitational waves are definitely my Sputnik, and maybe, I was already pretty excited about it, but it's one of those things that I remember discussing you know, just before the discovery with a friend of mine, and us saying that, you know, it might never even happen during our lifetime, you know, during my lifetime, and I'm so glad that it did. You know, with the Higgs, I don't know, I was more sure it would happen, but with gravitational waves, they've been trying for so long. So I was in New Orleans for a conference, and one of the two LIGO detectors happens to be an hour and a half a drive away from New Orleans in Livingston, so LIGO Livingston, and I got to visit, and it was amazing.
Yeah.
I think probably the most exciting thing was being in the control room. We were in the control room for about 10 minutes, and then suddenly they were like, oh, incoming earthquake, and we were like, what?
What?
Yeah, exactly. And they have all these screens, and they suddenly all turn to look at this one screen, and there it was, this huge spike on the screen. I'm like, bloody hell, that looks like a big earthquake, and couldn't help but sort of reach over for a desk, and I'm like, should we be standing under a doorway? I'm not sure. What was the feedback? And then they're like, oh, it's happening in Colombia right now. So there we were in the middle of Louisiana, and wow. There was an earthquake in Colombia that they were going, oh God, we might go out of luck. And yes. So that's just how bloody sensitive. And then we drove out to one of the far end of the arms. And I said, oh, can I go up a bit closer and take a few pictures? And the lady who was showing us around, who's Amber Stuva, who's also really cool and writes an amazing LIGO blog. You should definitely check her out. And she was like, yeah, you can walk up there, but just walk really softly and slowly and, like, don't jump around. And suddenly I was like a maniac. I was just taking these, like, really slow steps, like, yeah. Creeping up in the middle of the day to this giant tunnel. Like, she was like, oh, yeah, you're showing up on the screens there, but it's okay. They're nowhere there. And it's but that's literally how sensitive it is. Yeah. You know, they also have railroad tracks down the road, so they know the timings of every train that goes past, because, and all of this is fine, that their machine is now, their methods to account for all of these disturbances are so good and so accurate that they can deal with, you know, earthquakes in Colombia and tidal waves, tsunamis. It's phenomenal. It's amazing how, if there's an earthquake in Singapore, they know about it 4 minutes later. So it's actually a really good earthquake detector.
Yeah. But it's Large Hadron Collider. It found the Higgs boson. It's carrying on. It's got more important yep. things to do. They found gravitational waves. What are they doing now?
Well, they found one big set and the second set too. Technically, they should be finding loads and loads and loads of them from loads and loads and loads of different mergers and collisions and things like that, because gravitational waves, they're a bit like light. It's another way to look at the universe. And just like when we had radio astronomy and suddenly we saw all of these cool things like, you know, black holes and quasars and things like that started popping up really easily accessible to us. It's almost like that. They want to get to a point where you could use gravitational waves as a way to look at the universe. So they've got a lot of work ahead
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, but they can't, because we've only detected a couple. So how
well,
do they
yeah,
do that?
But that's... And that, they've only detected a couple... They've only detected a couple because they've detected just the really big ones, and they want to get to a stage where they're sensitive enough to detect even the smaller ones. And one of the main ways to do that is to just have more and more detectors across the world. We've got two now, but we've got...
They're also in collaboration with one based out of Italy, right?
That's right. So they're in collaboration with Virgo. So it's the LIGO yeah. Virgo. There's also GEO in Germany, which is smaller and has been running for a while already. Both Virgo and LIGO and Virgo and GEO are in their final stages before they get upgraded and come online. And then excitingly, there's CAGRA, which is in Japan, which is good because we need something on the other side of the world too, you know, so that we have a more comprehensive way of searching. It's the idea is to turn the entire planet into a gravitational wave detector, so that if these waves are coming from any direction, A, you detect them, B, you detect them well, and C, you can see exactly where they're coming from. But it's, LIGO's amazing, it's fantastic. There's so much more I could say about it, probably, yeah. But I won't.
I'll say it another time.
Another time.
Yeah, no, the human race has come an awfully long way from Sputnik. We've come an awfully long way from October Sky.
That's a nice wrap around.
And there's only really one place I can go from there, Carsten Becker.
Yeah, so we are pretty happy to announce that we have a new partner aside from Audi. And this is a partner which is helping us in a very strategic way, because the goal is that we want to build the first mobile network on the moon. And this is...
What?
You know, You know, you're laughing now, but when you're going there in 30 years for tourism opportunities, you will be happy to use our network, and we will charge astronomical roaming fees. So you get rich.
Yeah, amazing.
No, but I mean, in fact, it is very helpful to us, because the way the rovers are designed right now is that we are communicating to Earth directly. But the problem is that the energy that is required to communicate to Earth directly are about half of the total budget that we have for the rover driving. And so we have on the back of the rover, we have an antenna that needs to be pointed at Earth while you're driving in rough terrain. And, you know, in theory, it should work. But I think in practice, it's more difficult than it looks like. And so with LTE, which is, you know, the 4G standards, we can communicate between the rovers and Alina, our spacecraft. And so we don't have to use as much energy for communication while we're driving on the surface of the moon. And so this is a nice benefit for our first mission. But we as a company, we are offering payload to the moon. So if you want to fly something to the moon, you know, for just 750,000 euros a kilogram, you can send it with us. And judging from your laughing, you don't have that amount of money. But
no, I don't have
that amount of money. There are quite a few universities and other companies that are interested in doing that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. If anybody's listening to the podcast who wants to do that, then absolutely. get in touch. Yeah. How do people get in touch with you if they want to do that?
Go to our website, which is called ptscientists.com. You know, initially we were called part-time scientists, but, you know, our name has become a lie because we're not part-time anymore.
Yeah.
And so we now call ourselves PT scientists.
Okay.
Yeah. By the way, what really is important about it is that we're a commercial company and we want to make a living with what we are doing. And what we see the future in is building a colony on the moon. So it's the European Space Agency calls it the Moon Village. And we want to be an infrastructure provider for that. So be it 3D printing services or communication infrastructure, you know, we want to bring that to the moon and help them get it done.
Do you want to live on the moon?
If I could get there without strapping myself to an exploding body, I would be happy to. But I think I'm the guy that's waiting for the space elevator to happen.
Okay. Where will the rocket launch from?
So the rocket will launch from Cape Canaveral. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm. So have you booked tickets?
No. Problem is that I will probably be needed in our mission control during the launch. So I may not be able to see it live, which is really a shame.
Yeah. Well, listen, what we'll do is I'll go and I'll see it live. And maybe I'll Facebook Live it or something and you can watch.
Yeah. We will be pretty sure to watch the webcast about the SpaceX launch.
Yeah. Oh, look, SpaceX tonight, as we record,
exactly.
SpaceX tonight, they're launching with a reusable rocket for the first time. Is that right?
I'm so eager to see that, you know. I get used to seeing the launches just for the landing, you know, but seeing a reusable, or as they call it, flight-proven rocket, you know, then it's very interesting,
yeah,
I think.
Fantastic stuff. Thank you so much for talking to me, and yeah, we'll see you on the moon, I guess.
Yeah, you'll. Hopefully a bit before that. So if you're interested in watching what we are doing, you know, you can also go to missiontothemoon.com. This is our page where we are talking about what we're doing, and probably we'll be presenting our live feed from what we're doing as well.
I mean, how exciting is that? Sending rovers to the moon to trundle along to the Apollo 17 landing. Absolutely wonderful. Thank you. As ever, to Ty for joining me here in the Cosmic Shed.
You're welcome.
And Toshna, it's wonderful, always wonderful to have you. Please come again.
Lovely to be back.
And we need to do another Star Trek thing, I think.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
When does Star Trek Discovery start?
Soon, hopefully. Oh, I'm so excited.
So, yeah.
who was it who was out yesterday?
Rain Wilson is going to be Wilson. Harry Mudd.
Oh,
Mudd, yeah.
Amazing.
Mudd's winning. Interesting.
Anna Chintia, thank you so much for coming. I hope you've enjoyed your first visit to the Cosmic
Shed. Oh, it's my pleasure. I hope to come back soon.
As we've been talking, it's become clear that for the most, if not all of us, the shuttle missions were, to a certain extent, our Sputnik. And there's something quite lovely about that when you think that Homer Hickam, inspired by Sputnik, went on to train the shuttle astronauts. Thanks, Homer, and thank you for listening. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.